for teaching the gospel to the Gentiles and so forth. It is remarkable the kind of partnership that these two men formed. Now, the main thing about the background of this letter is not what's going on in Titus's life, it's what's going on in Paul's life when he writes it. This happens in the very last years of Paul's life, and it happens at a time when Paul is deeply concerned about what the future of the congregation that he has planted will be. He has been imprisoned where the book of Acts ends, which is somewhere around somewhere in the early 60s A.D., I think, when Acts 28 is over and Paul is under house arrest in Rome waiting his trial before Caesar. This book either happens shortly before that, or this is my opinion, and it happens after that. I think that Paul was released from that prison where we find him in Acts 28, and that he continued his work for the Lord for a while, and then that he was rearrested not too long a time after this, and then finally executed by the Romans. And I believe that it's easier than trying to fit this letter into Acts to think that it comes after that. And Paul has continued the work in the western part of the Roman Empire, and he has tried to provide for the continued training of the churches he has established, and especially to provide for leadership for those churches so that they will be well in the future. And what leads to that is it's become increasingly clear to Paul that his time will not be long in this world. His mortality has struck him, if you'll notice. And read the, if you notice verse 12 of chapter 3 for just a minute in Titus, you'll see what I'm getting at, I hope. Paul says, when I send Artemis or Tychicus to you, do your best to come to me at Nicopolis, for I decided to spend the winter there. Nicopolis turns out to be, I think, on the western side of the, is it the Greek peninsula or the Italian peninsula? It would be the Italian peninsula, and a lot of people believe that that's where Paul got rearrested. Now, that's the plan, for them to meet maybe at that place. But look back at chapter 1 and notice verse 5. And Paul makes clear here that he has left Titus in Crete so that he may put what remained into order and appoint elders in every town as I directed you. So you get an idea that they are, Paul and his co-workers, Timothy has been left, he's been sent to Ephesus, we've learned in 1 and 2 Timothy. Titus has been left on Crete to do this work. Paul is traveling in other places, and they intend to rendezvous at a place to spend the winter. So all these moving parts are going on, and you have to try to think about the well-being or the welfare of the church, the prospering of the church in these circumstances where the ominous clouds of persecution by the higher authorities are now on the horizon because Nero has already begun to assert some of his powers and authorities. Look, I wondered how you guys who have your Bibles on phones would do this. Look in the back of your Bible for that map for just a minute. I'm sure you know how to do this, but I don't, so I'm going to look at maps And notice where Crete is. What we're talking about here. If you look straight south of the Aegean Sea, which is between Asia Minor and the Greek Peninsula, you notice that the island of Crete is there. That is where Titus has been left to do this work. So you notice that he is somewhat isolated, and he's in a somewhat difficult situation to try to do the work that he has to do. Crete has a reputation that lends itself to being a laboratory for our study. Here are the three issues, or the three reasons that I believe this book, thinking about the church in the book of Titus, will help us to understand the church and God's purpose for it and our place as citizens in the world, in the secular world. Titus is a book that helps us to understand, or helps us to think about how God's purpose is to go from the church meeting into the world. How does this transition take place? How are we impacted by our meeting today, tomorrow, or on Thursday, or one of the other days of the week? And if you think about some of the ways in which this question is relevant right now, some of it we talked about school, some of you are dealing with those issues right now. We're in a political season. And all this summer and early fall, we're going to be, those of us in Missouri are going to be bombarded with claims from two different extremes. And you're going to have to figure out, how do my values, my spiritual values, apply to these matters that I'm hearing talked about? And then in the economic world in which we live, there are big issues and big choices to be made. Notice what Paul has to say to Titus in chapter 1, verse 12, for example. And think about what it's like. If you would, a lot of people plan to raise their families where they think it will be easier for them spiritually. We try to make choices about where we think of the mission of the church, where we might send missionaries, and it be a white field, a field white to the harvest, and so forth. Think about this. This is verse 12 of chapter 1. One of the Cretans, a prophet of their own, said, "Cretans are always liars, evil beasts, lazy gluttons." Now, that does not sound like a Chamber of Commerce brochure today. It probably wasn't put out by the Visitors Bureau of Crete. My study Bible says that it was from Epimedes of Greek, he was a poet, and that he was the writer of that. But think about this. This is the reputation this place has. Liars, evil beasts, in other words, they live like animals, and they are gluttons. All right, describe that in your words. Paraphrase this. No place names attached or anything. But what kind of a culture is he describing there? All right, ungodly would be it. It turns out that godliness is one of the main words of this little letter, one of the notes that gets struck very often in this book. Who else said something over here?
I was just going to say that it's a totally evil
place. All right, they were people who were not very spiritually oriented in their backgrounds, right? What I think of when I see that is self-interest, the pleasing of self, the gratifying of desires, the individual liberty part of this. Maybe you can see that kind of thing. Now, don't have anything to do with the culture we live in, right? What do you find to be the most difficult questions when you think about going from the church assembly into the world? How is that? What to you are the big issues in how that transition is made or is to be made? What do you find most challenging or most puzzling or most important about moving from the inside out like this, which is what Paul is concerned about in Titus? Okay, Lord?
I think when you're here on Sunday and Wednesday, you just feel so uplifted and you're like, yes, this is so great. And then for me, when I go back to school, I just feel so alone.
Okay.
You know, the conversations that happen with coworkers or whatever, I just feel kind of like the odd person out.
So you kind of feel like you don't belong. And would people who were devoted to God feel sometimes like the outcast in this culture here? Of course, that would be Russ.
I think it comes down a little bit to either influencing or being influenced and being in the world and not of the world.
Okay, so does the world get into the church, or does the church get into the world? And I'm using it in the latter sense here, the church getting into the world, and Russ is pointing out that one of the questions is, all right, does this arrow go this way, or does it go this way? That's a big part of the question. All right, and notice that in church history, there have been some big problems here. I mean, on one extreme, there has been the monastery where the church simply looks down on the world and regards it as hopelessly evil and has nothing to do with it and withdraws from it. And you pointed out that's not what we're called to do. And on the other hand, there is the accommodation, the temptation to accommodate so that the world feels so at home with the church that there are many shades of gray and no light and darkness. That's part of it. Anybody else? Tom?
I remember in the movie, toward the end of the movie, The Field of Dreams, where Dr. Graham, from a young player, stepped over the line and came back to reality to save the little girl who was choking on a hot dog. One of the great fortunes, and I say that sincerely, in my life has been most of my adult life to work in public service that has been daily involved in evil.
Yeah.
And I've tried to remember and use Dr. Graham's example as you transition from that good into that evil setting to do so as a servant.
Yeah, walking, dealing with law enforcement issues with that line of demarcation would be more obvious than it would be to most of us, but almost all of you folks here work or have worked in that public arena where the core beliefs that you have, even if your neighbors you work with are fine people, they may not share those same core beliefs. So you have that challenge to work with. Who else has it? Okay, Shauna?
Well, to me, it seems like when you're here, you have good coming in. And then when you get out there, there's so much garbage. It's kind of like garbage in and it's garbage out.
Yeah.
And there's just so much to influence. TV and radio and people and different situations where it's hard to build a shield against
that. It's hard to. Here's how I think of this. I thought of what you said a good bit. Is what we have when we're assembled together the place where we're away from the unreal in the real, or is what we have the rest of the time the real, and is what we share together here the pretend? That's the question has to be decided. What else? I'm interested in what you're saying about the challenge of taking a church into the world, Casey.
I think one of the toughest things is figuring out a way to bring people closer without pushing them away.
All right. We're going to talk about that one a little bit tonight, by the way, in our study tonight. And that is a huge issue. And you notice in our culture right now, do y'all read this like I'm kind of getting the impression right now that Christianity is more in disfavor in popular culture than any other religious outlook right now. And I'm not talking about us as a congregation, I'm talking about in general in our culture. And you think about what are the things that turn people off. Some of it has been the difference between our ideals and our identity. Some of it has been scandals, by very public scandals by religious leaders. Sometimes we have found it easier to sort of attack issues than we have to be who the Lord sent us to be in the world, and that's been a problem. All right, anybody else? I don't want to spend the whole time on this one, but
I don't know if this touches on what you were saying, but when I think about the church going into the world, I think the world as a bigger world than the United States, mm-hmm. and it seems, going on mission trips, it seems easier to talk to people in other cultures when they're not so self-reliant as Americans are. We're so self, you know, wealth and self-centered, that self, it's easier, it seems, to talk to people who don't feel that they have it all.
When they don't have a TV, why self?
Yeah.
A lot better.
I have noticed that the times that I've been in other places, and I'll be honest, I haven't been able to figure out how much of it came from my being blonde-headed and different, or how much of it came from them not having all of the stuff that we are used to here, so that we take it for granted we have food, shelter, and clothing and so forth, or how much of it is simply them being humbler than most Americans are and not thinking they already know everything. That's a part of it that I've wondered. So I think you can tell from the comment. Okay, Ruth, one more.
Well, I was just thinking that, you know, it says the world doesn't know us from our love. Mm-hmm. And maybe that even just a little light is better than no light.
Of course.
And the love
doesn't do it. The danger in my raising the question I raise here is to just look at all of the bad parts of it. The flip side of this, let me mention this, is that Paul could write to Titus and expect the church to be healthy in a place like Crete. Is that encouraging to you? Can the church prosper in a place where their own people write that about their neighborhood? We live in a lot better place than that, it's my opinion at least. And if the church could be strong and do well there, it can. Now, what Russ mentioned a while ago, I think the church was designed for the real world by the Lord, and it can function in the real world, and that's what it needs, the guidance of a letter like this to do so. All right, there's a couple other things that are related to this. All right, how do the great doctrines of Christ, what is doctrine, by the way?
Teaching.
All right, teaching, that's right.
The great doctrines of Christ would simply be the great elements of our faith, the great truths that Christians believe in, that have come from the Lord and that are the basis of our faith. How does doctrine get into life? Or I can say it a different way that fits the nature of this book, I believe. How does doctrine get turned into good works? How does the theoretical or the spiritual become the practical? I think four times, and maybe five times in the book of Titus, he'll mention sound doctrine, or the doctrine being the doctrine of Christ being honored or beautified or glorified by the way the people who believe it are living. Healthy doctrine being turned into doctrine that is adorned. This is chapter 2 and verse 10. By the lives of the Christians who live it. And what Paul tells Titus is see to it and kind of look at this, that instead of being unfit for any good work, the last phrase in chapter 1, these people are turning into people who are, Titus is to be a model of good works, chapter 2 and verse 7, and then the Lord's redeemed people are to be zealous for good works in chapter 2 and verse 14, and in chapter 3 and verse 1 they're to be ready for every good work, and that's set in the context of being submissive to rulers and authorities, to be obedient, in other words, as citizens, to be ready for every good work. And then in chapter 2 at verse 8, to devote themselves to good works. And then to chapter 3 and verse 14 again, to devote themselves to good works so as to help in cases of urgent need and not to be unfruitful. All right, I want to ask a similar question now. Obviously, if we could do this, then we probably would be doing this, right? The church would get into the world would be for the church to take, for members of the church, you and I, to take the doctrines that we believe in and turn them into good works in terms of everyday life. What is the biggest challenge about that? I have one or two in mind in asking this.
Reality of life and dealing with issues in your life that cause you to fall away or not be as involved or not be able to.
The demands of life that don't, yeah. Okay, the realities of everyday life, baby says. What else, Becky?
I think confidence in ourselves when we all have confidence in God.
Okay, so can I say lack of confidence, and that would work here? Anybody else? All right. The feeling like we don't know enough, or the lack of knowledge. Okay, anybody else? Russ?
Not exactly what you're asking for, but the connection between doctrine and good works. The last half of verse 10, he's talking about...
Which chapter?
2.
Okay.
Slaves being subject to their masters. It's so that in every way they can make the teaching about God our Savior attractive.
All right.
You know, that when we realize that our lives are going to reflect upon Christ.
All right. If we realize that our lives are going to reflect on Christ, that's crucial to how this gets done. The problems in it, I'm surprised nobody has said this. Okay, Ruth, maybe she will. Go ahead. No pressure, though. Okay.
I'm going back to the love. One of the main doctrines of Christianity is loving each other and loving God. I mean, any of the commandments relate back to loving each other and loving God.
Okay, okay.
And the outside world is not always easy to love.
Well, the inside world isn't easy. Okay. What Ruth said is related to what I think about this. So let me rephrase it this way. I think sometimes we don't think we are taking the doctrine, turning the doctrine into good works, because we think that requires something big to do it. And that normally turns in, at least this is what I've heard, that I'm waiting for me to take my identity as a member of the church into the world and turn my beliefs into good works. I'm waiting for someone to set up a program for me to participate in by which that could be done. Now, okay, Tommy.
That's extremely difficult in the world we live in today to find even a program, like there's a big program, because with my work schedule like it is, there's a pretty good chance, Bill, I'll see you next Sunday morning.
Yeah.
So
if I'm here.
If you're here, yeah. Right. And that's a problem, okay. Is being able to surround myself.
This is a good way to make the point that I think Titus makes here. If you notice, when Paul writes to Titus about good works, listen to what he's asking the people to do and calling good works. He's asking older men to conduct themselves in a certain way, and older women and younger men and younger women and servants and so forth. He talks to people about being citizens. And listen, for example, how husbands treat their wives and wives treat their husbands and so forth. Now listen, for example, to chapter 3, first couple verses. And I think that one of the challenges is to remember that common things in real life that are done for the Lord is the way to turn doctrine into good works. What if I were the most, this is a stretch, what if I were a dynamic leader, and what if I was famous all over the world but couldn't say a kind word to my children and would belittle them and humiliate them and mistreat them in public? Would I be doing what Ruth said is the answer to that? That wouldn't be good works, would it? That could be as self-centered as anything you could imagine. But look what it says here. Yes.
Ultimately, that would be the legacy that you would leave, the impression that you would leave on the world eventually.
Eventually.
Not what all these things you did out here.
Yeah.
How did you treat your family?
All right.
How did you treat your children? How did you treat your brother and sisters?
What kind of neighbor was I? And that's a great point. And this is the message of Titus. Look at chapter 3, verses 1 and 2 will do for right now. And this is from the ESV. Remind them to be submissive to rulers and authorities. What would that mean in turning doctrine into life? Be a good citizen, that's right. To be obedient, to be ready for every good work, to speak evil of no one, to avoid quarreling, to be gentle, and to show perfect courtesy toward all people. Okay, Casey?
I think the part where it says speak evil of no one goes such a long way in putting that good impression on the world, because that's what so many people are afraid of with religion, that they're going to be judged.
They're going to be put down. They're going to be...
Yeah.
That they're going to be attacked somehow or something like that. All right, maybe.
Well, basically, what we're saying is live with the impression of what we turn our lives into what we're trying to teach and make it so much part of our lives that we don't even have to work at it.
Yeah, I think...
And then that carries over into you're automatically going to do...
All right, and if...
Work, fib, or lip.
All right, that's a good way to say it, David. If you're doing this, then if a program by which good can be done comes along, I'm going to be interested in it, and I could be a participant in it, and I could help with it. That's
but
right.
You don't have to wait for a program.
That's right. That's right. And that's what Paul is going to say to Titus. Now, I got to say one more thing before this old bell gets us here. This is the third part of this. One of the things about the book of Titus, I believe, that is helpful is how does this get done from one generation to the next generation? Pardon? All right. You all have given me the answers to this, the problem that Titus deals with. I want you to think for a minute about the problems involved here. Is Christianity, can any movement, any spiritual movement become a three-generation thing? Or does what was a burning fire in this first generation here become a lukewarm interest in the second one and then a fading reality in the third one?
That's the reality.
Okay. How does this happen here? In Titus, what we find is an intergenerational church. If you look at chapter 2, you don't see a picture of a religious group defining its demographic and aiming for, choose whatever age group you can think of, 25 to 45, we'll say, or 18 to 25, or whatever. You don't find that. You find, if you notice in chapter 2, at verse 2, you got older men. At verse 3, you have older women. At verse 4, you have young women. At verse 6, you have younger men. And you find the vision here for how these people from different stages in life can share the experience of living in the Lord's family together and how they can treat each other with value and respect and build relationships with each other. So it is intergenerational, and then it is also, I don't even know if this is a term or not, but interrelational. I guess just relational would do it, but I'm trying to make the point that this letter envisions every Christian, every member of the church as participating in this process. And what Paul is looking for is, and why would this be of interest to him at this point in his life? Okay. I, for example, am even older than Barney. I'm having to think about what kind of work am I going to leave here one of these days? And will the faith that I have tried to help teach, will it result in a sound that Paul uses this word in this book? I think this word gets thrown around in the wrong way sometimes, but a healthy church. That's Paul's interest in this book. And if this exists, then notice what happens. We're back up here again, and this process is ongoing. And that's why this has become so important. What happens is we start with this flow chart. I don't mean this to be like a lawyer's flow chart, but we start this flow chart and we get to a place where there's something, I find a fault here. Or I find a fault here. And I just erase the rest of it. I just quit the process. And what Paul envisions, why he's writing to Titus is, look, you're here in the real world where there are these problems for this purpose. I want to write to you about, I want to give you, as an apostle, I want to give you the authority to do your part in this process, or more accurately maybe, to let the Lord use you in this process that's ongoing all the time.
I think you do that with the third thing a lot in smaller churches, but how do you do that in a big church?
I believe it goes on more than we realize. For example, I know that several of you here were involved Friday night or last night?
Friday night
in the older folks are serving the younger. You know, this never goes on in an easy way. When we were growing up at Clark Ridge, there were the older folks who sat up here, and then I believe we made it before the day when the young folks sat down front, didn't we, Barney? I'll say it that way. The back row is what I inhabited.
The connect the dot row.
Yeah, the connect the dot row, yeah. I guess what I'm trying to say, Debbie, is each of these has always been a problem, and we notice it more whenever we're closest to it. But try this approach now. What I'm saying is, even in a place like Crete, Paul thought this could be done. So we sometimes spot the difficulties, and maybe I've asked the questions, the wrong questions today, but we forget that why we're here is this has been done. And isn't it amazing that for example, we'll talk about the organization of the church in verses 5 and following chapter 1. And even after all this time, that's still, I see people leaving the bell ring. Y'all should have let me know. Okay.
Number 3 has been on my mind a lot
lately. It's on my mind too. And no comment about Debbie's age, but that happened as we progress generationally. How's that a good way to say it? Chatting?
Thanks, we face to this one is to make Christianity appealing. I mean, the way some of us act sometimes, claiming to be a Christian, why would anybody in the outside world want anything to do with
yeah.
it? You know, I think we have to make it a something they want to know.
I think the idea is if we let the Lord turn us into what He wants us to be, that happens. Now, I plead guilty to what you say, depending on which day. I'm a human being, and all of us are. And what I'm getting at is the Lord has worked in situations like this to work His will, and He still can. Next week, now, here's what I need everybody to do. Read through the whole letter of Titus. There's only 3 chapters. There's 2 pages in my Bible. You can do that. And do some research on Titus as a person. Look at a Bible dictionary or something and do some research on Titus as a person and where he worked with the Apostle Paul. Thank you for being with us today.